Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As of right now, there are 4,661 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the United States. That's according to Johns Hopkins University. Public health officials say because of a testing shortage, that number is likely to be much higher. The total number of deaths, tragically, is 85, and the total recovered is 17. Washington State has the highest number of cases, followed by New York and California. A mandatory shelter-in-place order went into effect last night at midnight in six Bay Area counties. People in San Francisco, Santa Clara, San Mateo, Marin, Contra Costa, and Alameda counties are being asked to stay home except for essential activities until at least April 7th. When you do go out to the grocery store or for a much needed walk in the park, just be sure to practice social distancing. Stay 6 feet apart from others. This is the first drastic measure to take place in the country, and really all eyes are on us. Infectious disease expert Jeffrey Shaman of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health told the East Bay Times that if this works, the San Francisco Bay Area will set an example, and if it is effective, others will follow. Joining us to talk about the latest and also to talk about when we might see a vaccine is Dr. Julia Shaletsky, Executive Director of the Center for Emerging and Neglected Diseases and the Immunotherapy and Vaccine Research Institute at UC Berkeley. Dr. Shaletsky has worked on screening for malaria and toxoplasmosis. Hi, Dr. Shaletsky. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm a great fan of your program. I've been listening for years. Glad to be here.
Well, that is so nice of you. Thank you so much, and I'm so glad to have you. Thank you so much for all of your work. I want to ask you, Dr. Shaletsky, what are your thoughts about the mandatory shelter in place in these six Bay Area counties? Because I'm now reading so many scientists across the country say all eyes are on us.
Right. I think it is a very good idea. I mean, it's painful and it's highly disruptive, but at this point, it's the best chance we have to mitigate what this virus could do and somewhat contain it. I would say it's already pretty late in the game, unfortunately. We should have done this earlier, probably, but, you know, every day earlier you do it, the better, because it's an exponential curve of how the virus spreads, which is, I think, fundamentally difficult for humans to understand because we're not wired that way, because exponential spread means it's like this old example of the chessboard. When you put one grain of rice on the first square and then you double it on the next, you have two, then you double it, you have four, and so it keeps going. And once you reach the last one, you already have more rice than you could ever fit in the, you know, in the entire sphere of the world. So it's massive how fast it can increase, particularly later in the game. So we have to do everything we can to curb the spread, just to get the healthcare capacity not totally overloaded fast, because if there's a contained spike of very many people getting sick in short order, we'll just completely overrun the hospital capacity we have, which is, I think, as you have reported in the past already, not great in the United States. We have very, very little surge capacity. Sometimes it seems like we can barely care for the people who are normally sick, you know, under regular circumstances. Now, we have a big epidemic with particularly affecting the elderly and immune compromised that all need pretty intensive care in the end to have good outcomes and to recover from the virus. And we're just trying to make sure there are enough hospital beds, there are enough intensive care beds, there are enough ventilators for these patients to get the optimal care they need.
In the East Bay Times, they reported on a major new analysis that's in the journal Science, and it reveals that the central challenge of this virus in China was people with mild or no symptoms, and they were the main drivers behind the spread. Can you talk about the significance of that?
Sure. I mean, I think it makes sense intuitively because the people who are sick, I mean, naturally you're staying home mostly if you're severely sick because you have a fever and you feel miserable. And if you're truly severely sick, you go to the hospital. But the difficulty is if you carry the virus, and this is data that has emerged around in the entire field of virology in the recent years when we did more surveillance because of better technologies now being available to do that. That is also true for flu, by the way, and other viruses, that a lot of the patients who actually harbor and shed the virus don't even know they have it, and some have very, very mild symptoms. So those people don't know they have it, and I think actually the population now is coming through in a major way. Everybody's very good when they're sick to contain themselves, I feel. But if you don't know you have it, you feel totally normal. I mean, you just go about your regular business and then you spread it around. So for these, I think that for that reason, the shelter in place is important because it affects anyone independent of if they feel healthy or sick. And so like that, you can make sure that fewer infections happen. The one of the problems we have currently is we don't even know how many people are infected because of this testing debacle that has happened. Mm-hmm. And like that, you have only, you know, estimates. I mean, we know the numbers that are reported of cases, but probably the actual number is at least tenfold higher, maybe more. They did a study in Seattle where they just randomly tested people and 8% of them had it. So that's a pretty high number if you think about it, pretty close to 10%, where it's just in the population, even if you don't know you have it. So That's why we need the shelter in place because, you know, and there's also phenomena that contribute, like those super spreaders, you know, that have been discovered for other diseases where one person can, for reasons that we don't fully understand, infect a whole lot of people. So some people shed virus more than others also. So I think shelter in place is good. It comes at a high cost. I mean, it's very disruptive for families, for, you know, people who work in the service industry, things like that. For people who can work remotely, maybe less so, but a big part of the population will bear the brunt of this. And honestly, I don't see much yet coming from politicians in order to ease that pain, because I mean, you're probably familiar with these numbers that only 40% of Americans don't have $400 or something to cover essential expenses. And I think people like this are people that we really have to help out now in this situation, because if you just stop working for 3 weeks, suddenly you're losing paychecks and an entire livelihood.
Exactly, and we're going to be talking about that in about 15 minutes.
Right.
But right now we're speaking with Dr. Julia Shaletsky, Executive Director of the Center for Emerging and Neglected Diseases and the Immunotherapy and Vaccine Research Institute at UC Berkeley. If you have any questions for Dr. Shaletsky on the importance of sheltering in place, we're also going to ask her about vaccine trials. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Thank you for the critically important work that you do.
Thank you.
And you know, now is the time when we find out how important KALW is in our lives, and it's the opposite of social distancing. So, now that I've said that, I have a question. Absolutely, thank you. And I have a question. My question is, I've been frustrated with how difficult it is to keep distant from other people in certain circumstances, like at the supermarket. It just, you know, people line up. I don't know how to handle that. Everyone isn't staying 6 feet away from each other. Likewise, on the bus, it's just not practical. So what should we do in those circumstances?
Yeah, so that's, I think the social norms around this are rapidly changing, you know. I think it becomes more acceptable now to just ask people to maybe stand a little bit away from you. I've seen in BART trains sometimes that people arrange by themselves so that only every second seat is taken. Right now, ridership is pretty low. But if you're really stuck, you know, standing between people, I see this still happening at airports, where I think it's actually way worse because there's like 100 people in line suddenly, you know, at the immigration or something. I mean, you just try to turn your face away from other people's faces in case they sneeze or cough and not touch anything. But ideally, you want to keep maybe, you know, 5-6 feet away from people, just to avoid, you know, if someone coughs or sneezes. I mean, the virus doesn't migrate to space, you know, it's not like it sees you and gets to you. It's basically through coughing, sneezing, surfaces, things like that, where the transmission can happen.
Well, that's a really important question, Mark. Thank you for calling. Do you have any other tips for people who still have to take public transportation and be in public spaces?
Right. I mean, I would try to, you know, minimize touching anything on the bus or in BART. Maybe carry some sanitizing wipes if you have one. Try to not touch your face. I mean, there is, when I go out now and, you know, I still have to go shopping and I have to touch certain things outside. I mean, there's no way around that. I'm just trying to think of my hands as really dirty and just not touch my face or scratch your eye. It's very hard to do that if you think about it, but it's worth just being mindful of it and conscious about it, and then you do it less. And then when I come home, first thing I do is I wash my hands thoroughly, and then I go about my business the usual way. But I think thinking, it's a technique you can use that people also use in the lab when they have to work under sterile conditions, is to just imagine, you know, your hands are really dirty or contaminated with something and you don't want to touch your hair or your eyes or your face. And that helps in remembering, because there's a lot of, we touch our face a lot unconsciously. You're not even aware. And then it's easier to transmit. The eyes are particularly sensitive because there's nothing really preventing virus entry in the eyes. Like the mouth still has a lot of enzymes, for example, that can destroy viruses. And, it's harder to get in, for an infectious agent, but in the eye, there's nothing there. So, that protects us.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We have another very important question from our next caller. Let's go to Betsy in Berkeley. Hi, Betsy.
Oh, hi. Hi, Rose. Thank you for the great programming you're doing these days. You always do, but this is so good. Yeah, I am a doula. I'm a birth worker, and I have a mom I'm working with who's going to give birth in the next 10 days or so, and I go to her home, and I'm very torn about how to handle this, because this kind of home health work, especially doula birth work, is so vitally important. You know, it's a mom at a vulnerable time of her life. I'm sure she's got her concerns about all this, and I don't want to put anybody in danger, but I also don't want to withhold the special kind of personal care that is so important when a woman's about to have a baby. So I'm really struggling with this. I've talked to some other doulas who are nurses who work in medical settings, and we're just all kind of talking about it. And I just wanted to hear anything your guest might have to say about this. Thanks.
Wow, thank you.
Hi, I was offline for just a minute. I think the question was about how can doulas protect themselves?
Yes.
Right. Well, I mean, you would follow the same precautions that nurses and doctors take when they work with patients, right? So personal protective equipment, you know, scrupulous hygiene measures, you know, wearing gloves, wearing, you know, a mask, N95 mask. And, you know, I mean, you can go to greater lengths, like, you know, having totally covered outfit and changing that after you see the patient. That's something people do, like when they take, basically dress up. It's kind of, it's a bit more extreme, but you could dress up the same way the nurses dress up when they take swabs from patients if you think there's a high risk of somebody being infected.
Wow. That's such an important question, Betsy. I hope that gives you some information, and
right,
we'll keep you in mind,
right,
on future shows and maybe even do an entire show about this, because it is so important. Today, we're joined by Dr. Julia Shaletsky, Executive Director of the Center for Emerging and Neglected Diseases and the Immunotherapy and Vaccine Research Institute at UC Berkeley. And if you have any questions for Dr. Shaletsky, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. or you can email yourcall@kalw.org. In about 10 minutes or so, we will talk about workers on the front lines and what is being done to protect them. Dr. Shaletsky, let's talk a little bit about a potential vaccine, a clinical trial evaluating a vaccine designed to protect against COVID-19 has begun at the Kaiser Permanente Washington Health Research Institute in Seattle. According to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the first participant received the vaccine on Monday. Can you just talk to us about why it takes so long to get a vaccine?
Yes. I mean, it is part of, you know, anytime you put out a new drug or a vaccine, you have to do, first of all, you have to develop the agent, which takes some time, and then you have to establish that it's actually safe to use. It's particularly important for vaccines, which get injected. And then third, you have to establish that it actually works and protects you from infection. So in this case, Moderna is the company who develops this vaccine. They develop a completely new modality. Normally, vaccines are proteins that get injected. Either it's an inactivated virus, for example, but for that, you first need to know how to grow the virus in addition. If for totally novel things, it's sometimes hard to do at scale. Or you take isolate a protein from the virus that you can express in bacteria, for example, antigen approach that's already ongoing. You purify protein, you inject it. This vaccine is different because it isolated mRNA and injects that. So they're trying to get the body to make the virus protein on its own, you know, and then that's going to be the antigen against which the body can generate antibodies. So this is a completely new, a relatively new emerging modality. There's not a lot of data in humans. I mean, we have really positive data in other diseases. For example, in Zika virus, it was used in mice, but in humans, not much known yet. This vaccine trial started very fast, so I just want to say all the others are still earlier in the stage. Moderna got through an exception to not have to do any animal studies and go right into humans, which is completely unheard of. But I think we have a good enough safety profile of these mRNA vaccines to be able to justify it. And so far, I haven't heard any adverse reaction yet from the patient that was given the first dose. That takes pretty long, so to even get something that you think will work and get it purified. If you inject something into humans, it has to follow really strict guidelines how pure it has to be. The whole manufacturing process is under a special level of quality control, GLP, GMP manufacturing it's called. So we can't just make this in a regular lab and then inject it in people. It's like it has to be a certified environment, so that every step is quality controlled, and it's a massive amount of record keeping and a huge paper trail. So that adds to that. And then you have to actually test it in humans. And for a vaccine, the first thing that you need to determine is that it's safe and that there's no adverse effects in people. And then the second thing is you have to determine if it protects from virus infection. So if you think about that question, you know, it makes sense. However, if you really think about how you're doing this practically, that means that it's going to take a while, because you can't just go take 100 people, give them the vaccine, and then infect them with the virus knowingly. You know? Right. So you have to, when you do an efficacy trial to see if it works, it's just the last stage, you have to vaccinate a group of people, not vaccinate the other group of people, that's the placebo control, and then just wait and see if they randomly contract the virus, and that will take some time until you get data. And then you have to also have testing in place, right, because maybe they have few symptoms, so I don't know how they're going to build this. But so it normally takes, you know, at least a year to develop this, because you have to first develop the agent, and you have to make sure it's properly manufactured at scale, larger batch for the trials. You want to use one large batch for the entire trial, so you can't just piecemeal it together in small purifications. It has to be one certified batch. Then you first try in the phase one trial with few people. I think now they're planning maybe 10 people or something to see if it's safe and if you have any adverse reactions. If people have severe adverse reactions, then it stops there. And then the phase two and three trials will address if you actually make antibodies against the antigen. That's something you can test with blood tests, pretty straightforward, and maybe they do this in phase one already, but the thing that's harder to show is that it actually protects you from virus infection, because you have to follow these patients then for a while and see do they get the coronavirus and what does the control group do. But I think, you know, a lot of this is rules that are in place for good reasons, but that we could also think about relaxing in this crisis as it's happening right now. I think most important, if you can show that the vaccine is safe and there's no adverse effects, I personally think, I mean, this is just my opinion, not the FDA opinion, we could try to just use it in severely impacted populations and see what happens. Because there's only upside as long as it's safe. Because if it's not protecting you from infection, you where you were before, basically in the same situation. And if it does protect you, then you have a net benefit. So there's also, you know, situations where things can move a bit faster, but it's all dependent on the regulatory agencies and how, you know, to get them on board on certain strategies. Because first we want to do no harm, right, with all of these trials. So the safety part is critical for that.
And public health officials and scientists say that it will take over a year before we have a vaccine. Does that sound about right to you?
In general, that's true. But what I just said, so now Moderna is already in clinical trials for safety, you know, one could do it faster also if we really wanted to and if the FDA agrees. So it basically would have to, first they would have to show it's safe. You know, I'm just making that assumption now, and that antibodies are actually generated against the antigen, so you have an immune reaction. Because if you vaccinate and you don't have an immune reaction, which sometimes can be a problem with the mRNA vaccines, there's no benefit in the vaccination, right? You want to get a strong reaction so that the coronavirus, when you inhale it, is recognized and destroyed, right? So that's the first thing they need to show. And then, I mean, we could accelerate from there. I mean, learning from crises such as Ebola, for example. For Ebola, it was a similar situation. There was a vaccine available, but the trial hadn't been done, because it's very hard to do a trial in Africa while you have an active Ebola outbreak, just logistically. And then the Ebola outbreak also was dying down before they could enroll enough people in the trial. So for a long time, we didn't really know if the vaccine had been made for Ebola was actually working, but they still used it under compassionate use protocol, which would also be possible now under this crisis, and did ring vaccination. So every time they realized somebody had Ebola, everybody who was in touch with that person got vaccinated, and also the doctors and nurses got vaccinated, and it worked. So with that data, they supported more compassionate use release. And so although we didn't have the perfect data, you know, to make the decision with a perfectly done double-blinded placebo-controlled clinical trial, we still were able with this approach under compassionate use release to vaccinate and help curb the Ebola epidemic in Africa. So things like that could be applied also in the coronavirus situation. I think critical would be to start vaccinating, you know, healthcare providers, doctors and nurses, because they're most in contact with severely ill patients. And we're already talking about capacity lacking in hospitals. So if 10-20% of medical personnel get sick, that capacity is going to be way, way worse, because each doctor treats a lot of people. So that, I think that should be a critical priority, to maybe enable ring vaccination-like model if safety is there and if the immune reaction happens. It's still too early to really tell if that's going to be the case, but there's definitely something one can do there, you know.
And Dr. Shaletsky, just briefly before we let you go, sure. We have an email from Rose, and she said, why did this not happen with the previous flu epidemics, bird flu, swine flu, mad cow disease? I don't remember everything being closed down like this ever before. What is different about this virus?
Well, the mortality, for starters, so more people die than from the flu epidemic. Flu normally is around, is less than 1% mortality, but this one, it's much higher. It hits people harder. It is true, though, that I think a lot of the things we're learning now, quite frankly, can be helpful in the future also to curb flu epidemic. The thing, there's also a large political cost and economical cost for a massive shutdown just as this. So I think for coronavirus is an unknown entity. It spreads globally. People are maybe a bit more scared. Flu is coming every year, and we have a vaccine. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work so well because we have to predict which strain is going to be there 6 months from now. I think one thing that's clear to me is a lot of the practices that are happening now, for example, that my kids, when the school was still open, actually had mandatory hand washing before lunch. That never happened before, and that should be part of every flu season moving forward, I think, because it can protect people the same way from flu, because we don't take flu as seriously because most, young, healthy people don't have, get over it fine, but it's also similar to coronavirus in that it hits immunocompromised and elderly people, vulnerable populations, really hard, and it can cause mortality. So I think the things that we do now, we should maintain in years to come to also curb flu epidemics.
Dr. Julia Shaletsky is Executive Director of the Center for Emerging and Neglected Diseases and the Immunotherapy and Vaccine Research Institute at UC Berkeley. Dr. Shaletsky, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and everybody stay safe, practice social distancing, and listen to the radio.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up after a quick break, we will talk about workers on the front lines and what is being done to protect them. We'll speak with workers at Trader Joe's, and we'll talk to a driver for Lyft. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about workers on the front lines. Last week, the Washington Post had a story about the first wave of coronavirus-related layoffs, and gig workers and workers on the front lines are really feeling the brunt of it. On Friday, the National Employment Law Project posted a blog on their website saying that gig workers cannot obtain workers' compensation for illness-related expenses if they contract the coronavirus at work. So a little later in the show, we're going to speak with a driver for Lyft. And so many gig workers are really out there calling on companies to have their back and provide paid and family sick leave. But right now, they're not seeing it. In the United States, there are 53 million low-wage workers, and many workers depend on tips for their livelihood. Joining us now to talk about workers is Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Labor Center, where he's been a labor specialist since 2002. Ken focuses on low-wage work, labor standards policies, and healthcare coverage. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined by Nicole Grigg, a freelance journalist in the Bay Area who decided to take a full-time job at a local Trader Joe's to ensure a steady paycheck and health insurance. Nicole and her coworkers are on the front lines during this crisis. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for including our perspective.
Well, thank you so much, Nicole. Why don't we start off with you, because you are on the front lines at Trader Joe's. We've all been reading the stories about long lines in the store and people grabbing as much as they can, putting it into their cart. So just tell us, what's your experience been like the past couple of days? I understand this is your first day off in a little while.
Yes, and please pardon the fact that my voice is very hoarse, but I've been doing a lot of talking and a lot of talking loudly over crowds and things like that. So I am tired, but I'm doing fine. I'm kind of, our experience has been, yesterday, I guess that's what I'll go to. Just after the mayor made her announcement about the shelter in place, we got mobbed. There's already a line outside of the store to get in the morning. So, we got mobbed again and with a little bit of panic. So for us, it is about being tired, managing the expectation of the customer and making sure that everything is calm, and then making sure that we are taking care of each other. Fortunately, Trader Joe's is really taking good care of us. They understand that this is really stressful and scary for a lot of people because they, you know, they've never gone through any of this. But they're offering us overtime with the pay to match. They're asking us, if you are sick, please stay home and you will still get paid for your day. You don't lose any pay. Just don't come in. They're feeding us. And you know, if you're feeling mentally exhausted, you know, they will allow you to go and, like, take some quiet time. If you are fearful of the environment, you don't have to come in and fill your shift, hence the overtime, because some people are either compromised health-wise or they're just scared, or their students and their parents have made them come home. So that's
right.
Where we're at.
And I understand the other night, Nicole, you actually worked for 11 and a half hours.
I sure did. I did. I worked from 11 a.m. until, 11:30 a.m. until 11 at night. And that was because we really needed to get this store back in order, so that the next day it wouldn't just still be in ruins. And, you know, now we've shortened the hours, so we close 2 hours earlier to give us time to actually unload those trucks, get the product on the shelves, make it look good, and sanitize. That's another thing that we're doing. Mm-hmm. We're sanitizing everything. So in that way, I feel good that we are in a clean environment, or as clean as it can be. And, of course, I wear work gloves all the time.
Right. So, I was wondering how you deal with that, because we're all being asked to practice social distancing, meaning stay 6 feet away from each other. But how do you do that when you're packing and unloading and dealing with customers?
Yeah, social distancing in this instance is not possible. It's simply not possible. The lines are, the checkout lines go the length of our store, all the way to the back, to the eggs and the butter, all the way to the front, to the register, and people are crammed in this space. And, you know, we're dealing with every single person. You know, thousands of people are coming by, and we're in close proximity. It's impossible to do that. So that is a concern for me, but it's not an overwhelming concern to the point that I'm not going to show up for work.
And before we let you go, Nicole, you are a freelance journalist in the Bay Area. You've actually done some great work at KALW. You decided to take a full-time job at Trader Joe's to ensure a steady paycheck and health insurance. So you are getting health insurance, you do get overtime, and you do get paid time off.
I get all of that. And,
okay.
I'm so grateful. I know that other stores are not as lucky, where they're, you know, people are getting laid off and stuff like that. And I do feel very grateful. And that's why I'm dedicated to going to work. And, you know, I just want to say that we are supporting each other. We have, you know, we're checking on each other to make sure that, you know, the stress isn't getting to them. You know, some people are crying. Some people are just straight stunned. You know, some people have, you know, we have to have a smile on our face, because if we don't, then our customers get scared as well. So I do feel very supported. I do feel very fortunate that I'm in the position to have a job where other people are getting laid off. I used to be a gig worker, and it's a hard hustle. And my heart goes out to everyone out there, food delivery, grocery delivery, working in, as an Uber or Jazz, Uber and Lyft driver. It's a really, really hard hustle, and it's uncertain. And, you know, now that people aren't commuting, you know, how are people making any money out there? I really feel for them. And, mm-hmm. And I really appreciate, the position that I'm in, where I can help people and not be fearful that I'm going to lose my apartment.
Oh, yeah. Well, Nicole, thank you so much for spending some of your day off with us. And thank you for all of the important work that you and everybody else at Trader Joe's is doing. We'd love to have you back in the coming weeks.
Okay. I appreciate your time, Rose. And thank you so much for all that you do on this show. This is exceptional programming. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Nicole. Get some rest today. Thank you so much. That is Nicole. Nicole, I'll see you online. That's Nicole Grigg, a freelance journalist in the Bay Area, and she decided to take a full-time job at a local Trader Joe's to ensure a steady paycheck and health insurance. And she and her coworkers are on the front lines during this crisis. We're also joined by Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Labor Center. And Ken, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what companies are actually taking care of their workers. And it really sounds like Trader Joe's does, with overtime, sick time, a paid time off, and health care and health insurance.
Yes, Trader Joe's is providing paid sick leave. In California, employers are required to provide paid sick leave by law, although in general, the state law is only 3 paid sick days. In San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, and Emeryville, it's higher, but it's really insufficient. Mm-hmm. So low-wage workers are less likely to have access to adequate paid sick leave, more likely to be in the kinds of service sector jobs that put them in a greater possibility of exposure to coronavirus, less likely to have any kind of financial reserves so they can make a decision not to go to work if they're not feeling well. And then, of course, now we have many low-wage workers who are in the kinds of occupations that are shutting down due to the shelter in place. Low-wage workers are much less likely to be able to work at home. And in the Bay Area, we have 250,000 workers in leisure and hospitality, you know, hotels and restaurants, and another 100,000 in non-food retail. Those are jobs that generally are being shut down right now.
And Ken, I just want to ask you about what's happening at the federal level. The Wall Street Journal is out with a piece this morning, and they report that the Democratic-led House scaled back a paid leave program that the chamber had tried to enact days earlier, following pressure from businesses worried about financial burdens from the sweeping bill in response to the coronavirus. In revised legislation that Democratic leaders billed as a technical correction, but represented a significant rewrite, the House modified a program aimed at providing paid leave to people affected by the coronavirus. Now, there's been a lot of information being shared by Public Citizen, for example, and they tweeted that companies like McDonald's, Walmart, Burger King, Pizza Hut, Subway, they currently do not have paid sick leave policies in place. So what can be done to ensure that they give workers sick leave? And what is your response to the Wall Street Journal report?
Yeah, incredibly disappointing to see them scale back the program. I mean, as it was, the program was only applied to companies with 500 or fewer workers, and it required paid sick leave, but also provided tax credits to pay for it. Some of the occupations they were excluding were in healthcare, where they're afraid that people would take paid sick leave and not come to work. And those are the occupations where it's most important that people be able to take paid sick time if they're not well. So this is disappointing. There is a lot we can do here at the state and local level. I mentioned earlier, some cities like San Francisco have a minimum of 9 paid sick days that are required. Other cities that do not have higher paid sick days should be putting that into place now. And San Francisco and other cities should be considering legislation to do emergency paid sick days to cover the full 14 days that people might need right now. So there is a lot more that we can do, and especially to reach those larger employers that are not covered in the federal bill.
Well, exactly, Ken. And if you're, I mean, an ice cream shop down the street is clearly much different from Amazon. Right? I mean, Amazon is making massive profits. The CEO pay is off the charts. And I'm not talking about people who work in Seattle in the tech section of Amazon. I'm talking about the warehouse workers.
Absolutely.
What, What can politicians do? It seems like at this point they really need to force these companies or mandate these companies provide sick leave. Because recently Nancy Pelosi tweeted, large employers and corporations must step up to the plate and offer paid sick leave and paid family leave. But they don't step up to the plate. So how do you mandate that?
Well, you pass laws requiring them to do it.
Right.
And, you know, we've done it on... Again, not as much as we need to in this state, but we could right now at the state level expand our requirements, and cities can take action as well and should. The other thing that we're facing, and I know you're getting to, is we can look at there are a set of protections in place for workers right now in terms of paid sick leave, disability insurance, their unemployment insurance. They're insufficient, but low-wage workers do have access to those programs. When we look at gig workers who are being misclassified as independent contractors, they don't have access to paid sick leave. Some of the companies have said they're putting into place a policy of paid sick leave, but it applies if they're diagnosed with coronavirus. That's really grossly insufficient. We don't even have that. Most people aren't being tested. So the enforcement of AB 5 and making sure that workers get the rights they have as employees is extremely important right now for gig workers who may be either continuing to work and are facing possibility of exposure in sort of the delivery services, or workers who are driving for Uber and Lyft and seeing their work diminish, making sure that they have access to unemployment insurance. And in that case, if people are losing work, they should go ahead and apply for unemployment insurance.
Well, hold that thought, Ken. That is Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Labor Center. I would now like to welcome a gig worker to the show. MJ has been driving for Lyft for 5 years. He's a leader with Gig Workers Rising. He organizes alongside fellow drivers to fight for better working conditions and to build a powerful movement of gig workers. Hi, MJ. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, am I MJ?
Hi, good morning.
You've got me confused. I'm an Uber driver.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But you, but I'm the one that sent you an email yesterday that you told me to call up.
Oh, okay. We have a Lyft driver who's supposed to be calling right now, so something got mixed up. Sorry about that. Well, I'm really glad you called in. I should mention that we did reach out to Lyft and Uber, and we asked them to join us. I even said, if you cannot join us, can you just send us anything about what you're doing for your drivers? And I only got a response back from Uber that just said, we cannot join you. No more information. So can you tell us what has Uber communicated to drivers? What's your experience been like the past few days?
Okay, well, it's the same thing as your previous speaker just mentioned, that they'll give assistance, quote unquote, to somebody who actually has the virus or has been told to leave, you know, has been told not to work by a public health professional, but that's like basically nobody. There's no tests available. And even if there are tests, that's still going to be a small amount of people. Basically nobody's really covered for anything. They've used that as a public relations thing about how they're taking care of things, but nothing at all, really.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You go ahead.
So you sent me a couple of messages that Uber has sent out to drivers. So nothing is being done? I mean, are they offering any time off? They're saying that you can get time off if you're diagnosed, but how do you know you have the virus given that the testing is so limited?
Exactly, and that's part of it. And what they mention is assistance. They're not saying that they know exactly how much money everybody makes, by the way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you've got somebody that's off for 2 weeks, they would know exactly how much money they'd be missing. They're not offering to duplicate that at all. They're doing something called assistance, which I'm sure would be some kind of minimum.
Right.
Having dealt with them in the past.
What has your experience been like the past couple of days? Our intern actually drives for Lyft, and he said his pay has taken a drastic cut.
Oh, the pay has taken a drastic cut. But there's also one other thing I'd like to mention just to the general public. There's no possibility of being 6 feet away from anybody in an Uber or a taxi or any of those kind of vehicles like that. Right. And I know you've been telling people not to wear masks, but I'm wearing N95 mask for the public safety. And I think anybody who can get a mask of any kind should wear it before they go into this confined space. And they certainly, it's amazing how many people I get in there that are coughing and don't have Kleenex. You know, I mean, for the general public, use a little common sense.
What are you planning to do in the coming weeks, given that you say that Uber is not offering any protections and your take-home pay is going down?
Yeah, well, I know it's not a good time to look, but I'm looking for something else. Mm-hmm. I don't have any money saved either because I just fixed my car. So, I'm between a rock and a hard place, frankly.
Let me bring Ken back in here. Ken, a lot of our listeners are gig workers, self-employed. Now, the Employment Department in California does have a document you can fill out to receive a claim if you're losing work. But does this apply to an Uber or a Lyft driver?
If Uber and Lyft drivers are losing work, they should absolutely fill out those claims. And those claims will get adjudicated by you all folks. And under AB 5, these workers should be classified as employees. So there's no guarantee that you'll get the claim, but people should absolutely fill those out. And I think another thing just to bring in to this is the gig companies, of course, have a ballot initiative that they're collecting signatures on that would set the rule, set over rule AB 5 and set another set of rules for gig workers, and as it doesn't include any paid sick leave, and it would actually prohibit the state or local governments from requiring that gig workers get paid sick leave. So that would make this situation in the future even worse, would also then limit any kind of liability for unemployment insurance in the future. So people should really pay attention to that, and I know one of the gig driver organizations put out a call saying that the $110 million that they had collected for the ballot initiative should go instead to relief to workers.
Mm. Well, MJ, I want to end with you. What protections and what would you like to see Uber do to take care of its drivers?
Well, what protections? Well, you know, they should be. You're talking about hospital workers having the masks. And disinfected, well, I mean, what's the saying? Ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. You know, if you've got sick people working, they're going to be spreading the virus. So they should be at least giving out masks, and also disinfectant. But apparently they claim that's hard to get a hold of.
Wow. Well, MJ, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back. I mean, we're trying to get Uber on the line. We constantly write to them, and all we got this morning is that we respectfully decline an interview for this. So we're going to stay on it. If anyone's listening who works at these companies, we'd love to have you on to ask you questions about how you are going to take care of your workers who are putting themselves on the line by driving. Thank you so much for joining us, MJ. And please, anytime, email us if you have any show ideas or any stories you'd like to share.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much. Ken Jacobs is chair of the UC Berkeley Labor Center. Thank you, Ken. We're going to continue following this issue to let people know how they can get some relief, so we'd love to have you back.
Great. Happy to do it, and thank you for having me on.
All right, thanks for your work, Ken. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any show ideas or guest ideas, please email us yourcall@kalw.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.